Okay, hi, this is David Roberts. I'm the senior staff writer at grist.org for climate change and energy politics and related issues. I have on the phone with me Jim Manzi, who is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a technology entrepreneur, a blogger at a number of sites, including National Review and the American Scene, and a man who is probably sick of being called the reasonable conservative on the issue of climate change. Jim, how's it going today?
It's going great. I'm in New York, where the temperature is about 10 billion degrees below zero right now. So I'm glad to be in a warm room.
I know. Clearly, the whole thing's a hoax.
Yeah, no, that wasn't meant actually to be a dig at global warming. I just was whining about the weather.
Yes. Speaking of hoaxes and whatnot, we've been instructed to begin with the topic du jour, which is so-called climate gate Swift hack, depending on what you want to call it,
right.
The stolen emails from the British climate research, climate modeling facility. So what's your take on all this hubbub?
Well, I think it's mostly a lot of ado about not a whole lot. I think it's a smoking gun with at most very tiny traces of smoke. I've believed for a long time that one of the two big trouble areas in the scientific case for anthropogenic global warming is long-term temperature reconstruction, which is not to say that I think the science is not there's not a real risk derived from scientific knowledge from global warming, but this one part of the case has been a weak area for a long time. And I think what people are seeing right now is a combination of what it looks like inside the sausage factory of any kind of science, exacerbated by this particular topic, which is trying to figure out what temperatures were, hundreds to 1,000 or more years ago, being a scientific topic in which you can't run experiments to adjudicate debates, so they tend to go on and on. I think likely its only real long-term effect is it's a negative PR event for one side of the debate. But I don't know if you have a different take than that.
That sounds reasonable to me. I think one thing I'm not sure the public understands about it is that you're correct that this is one area of climate science where there are lots of extremely difficult technical issues, and it's probably sort of one of the shakier and more speculative lines of evidence, if you want to call it that, of many lines of evidence. But it's also this particular area of science and these particular scientists who are involved, the ones who are emailing back and forth. This particular area of science has also been the focus of skeptic attacks for a long, long time. So some of these very scientists who are emailing back and forth have kind of grudge matches against particular members of the skeptic community that go way, way back. So I mean, obviously, that's not to excuse any shenanigans with data or any sort of refusal to show data or anything like that. But I do think it's helpful background information to know that these are not just scientists plucked at random from the scientific community. There's a lot of history to hear.
Yeah, I agree. And I also don't think it's random, to extend your point, that this turned out to be an area where critics got a lot of traction. Because I think critics have thrown a lot of spaghetti against the wall of the scientific case, and it's only stuck in a couple of areas at all. And I think the degree to which it's stuck here is driven by the fundamentals that I was trying to point out before of this being a scientific topic on which, in the end, we can't run an experiment and prove, what was the temperature in North America in 1120. In areas where you can do that, there have been tons of skeptical arguments. It's just they all get disproven by the scientific process. I mean, you just really can't dispute the point that carbon dioxide molecules redirect infrared radiation. I mean, you can if you just want to be alienated from the entire scientific enterprise.
Or you can.
I've qualified it carefully. You're right. I've had these debates, with people on the other side of the right side of the aisle frequently. And, the reason why I think the ghost has been all but given up by folks on those kinds of topics is you just really have to be a crank at a certain point to argue with certain right. findings. I think that is not true with what's really been reasonably valid criticisms of parts of the climate reconstruction case.
Yeah, well, part of the difficulty in this political environment is picking out those legitimate lines of critique and those legitimate points of critique out of a real haze of bad faith and accusations and very personal feelings and et cetera, et cetera. I think the emails reflect that.
Yeah, I agree.
A bunker mentality.
Yeah, I agree.
So, I think we would agree that in the larger picture, you know, the case for anthropogenic climate change is based on multiple lines of evidence, multiple areas of science, been multiply peer-reviewed, and even should sort of the worst accusations about these particular scientists and their work be borne out, the larger case is still fairly sturdy. And so, like you said, this is mostly a political event.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I wanted to make one additional point about ClimateGate before we move on to Copenhagen, which is one of the things that puzzles me, and this is a new book out by the guys who write at DeSmog Blog, James Hogan and his colleagues at DeSmog Blog. It's about the effort to obscure climate science going back a couple of decades now. And the amazing thing to me is there's this industry on the right. It began, I think, around the tobacco wars, where they sort of set up foundations that could churn out stuff that looks like science and put people on TV that look like, that have scientific credentials. And this sort of, the notion of manufacturing doubt about the gathering of science against tobacco and, you know, all the same techniques of playing on people's doubts, playing on people's inability to sort through scientific information. The same sort of industry that's been built up among the Competitive Enterprise Institute and Stephen Malloy, you know, all these same people have been, they did it on tobacco, and then eventually were exposed that their science was fraudulent and that they were wrong and that they knew they were wrong and that they'd probably helped contribute to, you know, several thousand, 100,000 deaths or whatever. And then they did it on CFCs around ozone, and they did it on, you know, there's been this whole series, the same set of institutions and people have lied about the science of what corporations, about corporations' dangerous products over and over again. And so what baffles me and what I never understand about this is why every time they approach the media with a new shiny bauble, a new story, a new faux story, every time the media just seems to take them at face value all over again, like over and over again, science mm-hmm. and scientists are stuck defending their credibility, but this industry of sort of professional obfuscators never becomes the focus. It's very mm-hmm. mysterious.
Well, I've written about this and something kind of like it, in fact, in Right of Center publications, so kind of talking to those folks rather than to their antagonists or interlocutors. And let me try and give you my take on how the dynamic works from the right, and then maybe talk about why I think, while there's a degree of truth and more than a germ of truth to what you're saying, there are two sides to it. And so to start mm-hmm. with, I think the way the dynamic has worked, and it's been a real, not just kind of political error, which I think it has been, but an error in the attempt to find, you know, what's true by those mm-hmm. on the right, which has repeatedly happened, which is, there will be an argument made in the public sphere that scientific finding X implies political action or moral or ethical conclusion Y. You know, the fact that we, by putting more carbon dioxide molecules in the atmosphere, we drive temperature up, implies we need a global regime of a carbon tax. Accepting, right. you know, the modern synthesis of evolutionary biology implies being an atheist, right? And right. People on the right routinely have gotten in the habit of saying, I don't like conclusion Y, so I will attack the underlying scientific finding X, instead of the much more logical and sensible line of attack, which is challenging whether X really implies Y, right? And that dynamic happens over and over. And so I think it is more sincerely motivated. I mean, there are mercenaries everywhere, but it is generally more sincerely motivated than what you're describing, but I think a mistake nonetheless. I think that the reason why it's not an entirely one-sided dynamic is that it is also true that, you know, science is a capacious term that is used, you know, very capaciously in political debates. And one can call lab bench chemistry and particle physics science, and one can call, to take another extreme, psychology and social science science, but there are material differences between them. And I think a lot of the science that is the underlying basis for at least many of these debates we're describing are gray zone sciences where falsification is very difficult. So in systems science, environmental science, areas where running crucial experiments that can determine whether a particular theoretical predictive rule is correct or not are much more difficult to execute. And so I think what happens on the other side is that the other side of the debate is that there's an attempt made to drape the term science over findings which are debatably of the same provenance of, you know, Newton's laws of motion. And I think this dynamic that's happened where most actual, you know, academic scientists and most academics are grossly disproportionately politically identify as liberals. I'm not saying that influences their work in any way, but it is an empirical, measurable fact that's true. This antagonism that has developed between basically the political right and anybody with, you know, a PhD in the United States exacerbates this. You know, it really exacerbates this problem, and it has caused not really, I don't think, damage to the scientific enterprise, but it's made it extremely difficult for our political process, or more difficult than it ought to be, to integrate scientific findings into, you know, rational policymaking.
The one thing that scares me, I think this climate gate, I think you're right that this will ultimately be another tempest in a teapot and will pass without substantial effect on the flow of climate politics. But what's starting to scare me is it seems like maybe you have a different take on this, but it seems like this is the first time where this set of people, and I know that there is a constellation of people who are quite sincere around or next to these hacks, for lack of a better word, but the hacks are certainly there. But this seems like the first time, rather than saying we have competing science or just the science is uncertain, this seems like the first time they've really turned their guns directly on the institutions of science, the practice of peer review, the very sort of, you know, what science as it has developed in the West. And if they manage to sort of relativize that and make that just another sort of he said, she said political debate, you know, we're entering a kind of postmodernism that makes political action, you know, all but impossible, it seems like.
Yeah, I think this is very related, actually, to the point I was making, which is I believe that, to take a more extreme case, because I think climate reconstruction is a gray zone case, but to take a more extreme case, it is my view, for example, that all of macroeconomics is he said, she said. That we can call it scientific all we want, but as I think, you know, the world generally is coming around more to my point of view over the last 18 months. But I believe that all of economics is macroeconomics is has no experimental foundation and is therefore ultimately he said she said, which is not to say it's valueless or it shouldn't be done or it should not inform how we make decisions in any way, but it is he said she said in a way that the findings of quantum mechanics, as abstract as they are not. And so I think that a lot of the, if you were to see the critics' case in its best possible light, which is hard to do, but if you see the critics' case in its best possible light, I really think what they're attempting to show, whether they succeed or not, is climate reconstruction belongs on the he said, she said side of the aisle, not on the physical chemistry side of the aisle.
I agree, obviously.
Exactly. I'm oversimplifying grossly by being binary about it. But I think you know what they're doing is trying to say, look, you can pound the table and say it's science, you know, back off all you want. But if we actually look at the practices you're following and the evidence you have, you know, this is the argument the critics are making. It is not science in the way that word is used in common parlance. And I think that it is climate reconstruction, again, unlike the physics of, you know, how CO2 interacts with radiation, you know, there's a case to be made there that's not trivial.
Right. And let's not forget all the empirical evidence from the field also supporting climate change.
Yeah, exactly. To reemphasize your point, even if, I made this exact point in one of the only blog posts I've done in the last few months, which even if except everything the critics are saying is true, it doesn't lead to the conclusion that, you know, this is the climate science is all a hoax and global warming is a hoax. It just is about one line of evidence.
Okay, well, let's move on then. The other big story happening in the climate world, obviously, is the Copenhagen, the COP15 climate talks going on in Copenhagen.
Yep.
Every NGO and journalist on the planet seemingly has crammed their way into Copenhagen, and negotiations are underway. I feel like, having watched a lot of the flurry of news, one theme that emerges over and over again is this tension, which has been long-standing, but is once again now kind of boiling over, this tension between developing countries and developed countries, and even to some degree among developing countries. We can get into that later, but I just want to, rather than getting into the details of the back and forth in Copenhagen right now, I just want to back up and ask a more sort of philosophical question almost, which is, what's your take on the basic proposition that Western countries, by virtue of the fact that they have contributed the bulk of the CO2 that's now in the atmosphere, I think it's something like 75% historically, have a unique responsibility to do more and to pay more because they have effectively run up a debt? That's a strain of thinking that runs in and out of Copenhagen. I just wonder what your take on that is.
Well, I think that, again, there's an element of truth to it, but I think it is really oversimplified and artificial. And the reason I say that in the most simple terms is this, that it is correct, I think, to say that the product of the sudden change in economic circumstances that happened in first Northwestern Europe and then its offshoots and is now spreading to the rest of the world created many global effects. One of them was it pumped a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere. Another was figuring out how power turbines work and that you can use penicillin to cure diseases and how democracy can work at scale and so on. And along with all the CO2 we put in the atmosphere, inevitably knowledge of that kind, as examples, leaked. And so to choose one external effect called CO2 and say, we're going to attempt to track this across borders over the last 200 years and add up, in an accounting sense, a debt owed by the people who emitted the CO2 to the people who are feeling its effects, I think is entirely artificial and arbitrary. If what you want to say is, I want to add up all of the positive and negative effects that any country has ever had on any other country for the last 200 years and tote them up in total, and start moving money across borders to reflect that, you would have an intellectually consistent argument. But I think it illustrates how totally artificial and unrealistic it would be to do something like that. And in my view, if you isolated only one of those effects, totally morally unsupported.
I guess I have a trouble arguing with that. I know this is a real article of faith among the kind of young campaigners who are in Copenhagen and among developing countries, but I'm not sure it's the most morally or philosophically defensible position. I think there are other ways to justify the same outcomes. Interestingly, today or yesterday at Copenhagen, Todd Stern, the lead U.S. negotiator, explicitly rejected that notion. He explicitly rejected the notion that the U.S. has a debt to pay. He was what I think is more sensible, just saying, focus on the math. We can see how much CO2 there is, where it's currently coming from, and who has to trim theirs back to get where we need to go, and let's focus on that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, these are such charged negotiations that I feel like a lot of people feel like having a moral, kind of a moral cudgel is helpful.
Yeah, my take on it is that if you think it through, I don't think it's a compelling argument. It doesn't mean it won't be effective in some way, politically in some context, but I am unpersuaded by that argument.
Well, you, I know you're a skeptic about the entire process of trying to forge a multilateral treaty. What's your, why do you think what's going on in Copenhagen is the wrong way to go about it?
Well, I guess if one were to think about it from, I guess, a global perspective to start with, I think the fundamental problem with arguments for using coercive power of government to force rapid reduction in emissions of greenhouse gases, whether that's through a carbon tax or cap and trade or regulatory apparatus or anything else, is that I don't think the numbers go around at all. And I think if we take the UN IPCC, which, as you well know, is the UN body that is the several thousand scientists who won the Nobel Prize and produce roughly every 5 years the major reports that integrate our technical knowledge on the subject, I think a direct reading of those reports makes it clear. Basically, under a reasonable set of assumptions for world economic and population growth, we should, according to the IPCC, expect the world to get a little less than 3 degrees centigrade hotter over the next century. Second, according to the UN IPCC, getting about 4 degrees centigrade hotter should cost the world something like 3% of GDP. And so, you know, if we're 3 degrees hotter in, say, 2100, that means, who knows, we're 4 degrees hotter in 2120, 2130, 2140. You know, well over 100 years from now, the world is going to be 97% as rich as it otherwise would be, which, by the way, on a per capita basis, is much, much, much richer than we are today in any scenario consistent with those emissions. You know, that's just, that is not Manhattan's underwater and the world's coming to an end. It's a lot of dough in absolute terms, but it's just the numbers don't support the apocalyptic rhetoric. And therefore, it's not a surprise if you actually do the calculation to say, realistically, how much economic consumption we have to give up today in order to avoid that warming. It becomes extremely difficult, even in the theoretical lab case of I get to be world emperor and order everyone in the world and they actually obey me to do things, something like introduce a pure carbon tax. Even under those conditions, it's extremely difficult to justify. And in a real world of geostrategic competition and domestic politics, as evidenced by the things we saw like the European trading system or the Waxman-Markey bill in the United States, I think it's, you know, it is very difficult to conceive of a program to do this which generates benefits in excess of cost.
Hey, can you hang on just 1 second? My office lights have automatically turned themselves out. That's how energy efficient we are here at Griff. Let me turn it on 1 second.
Sure.
Oh, look, it was motion sensitive. All I had to do was move around a little bit.
I think it's a metaphor for not casting light on the argument.
No, the longer I'm still, the more the darker it gets.
Right.
Well, you know, you and I have been back and forth about some of this before, and there's some assumptions in there that I think are worth teasing out. But I think if I could just get to the heart of your point, it's that the target that the international community is shooting for in terms of emission reductions are not justified by the science and would do more harm than good. And ergo, it's not worth trying to forge a treaty to get there. I mean, is that
correct?
Fair?
That's right. I mean, obviously, we're operating at a pretty general level here, but yes, I think that is the essence of my argument, which, again, is not based on Jim Manzi's analysis of the situation. It's just reading the reports that have been produced by the bodies that study it.
Right. Well, one thing I think I know people have taken issue with you before, and I think justifiably so, is that, for one thing, the IPCC economic projections they include in them some fairly substantial energy policies on the part of countries. You know, I think it's, I know you've been back and forth with Joe Rahm about this, but as he says, if you do nothing, if their genuine do nothing scenario, you end up with 6, 7, 8 degrees, which is unequivocally horrible. Mm-hmm. So the question is, and we don't have those, even the policies that the IPCC assumes in its base case, I think are reasonably ambitious, and we don't have those in place yet. So it seems to me there's at least baseline an argument for getting those that minimal set of policies in place to improve our efficiency and so forth. And then secondly, I don't know if you saw, I'm sure you did, a set of 26 scientists just a couple of weeks ago set out, because the IPCC process is, for a whole variety of reasons, extremely conservative. It moves very slowly. The 2007 report, you know, the cutoff for papers that could be involved in that report was a couple of years before 2007. So right now, I mean, the IPCC report that we have in front of us contains science that's almost 5 years old now. And a set of scientists just a couple of weeks ago, 26 scientists, I think like half were involved in the IPCC, half weren't, tried to do a kind of mini, a miniature, faster version of the IPCC. Just look at the science that's come out since then, since 2005, and try to synthesize how it, you know, what it says to, in terms of updating the IPCC. And their conclusions were pretty uniformly negative, that the ice is melting faster than anybody thought, you know, so all, and sea level rise is now projected to go faster than the IPCC projections. Basically, on almost every metric, things have, all the new science is pointing in one direction, which is worse. Now, I'm sure you've heard this argument before. I'm curious what's your take on it is.
Sure. So on the first point, which is that the baseline scenarios in the IPCC include policies, they do include some. In fact, I guess we'll post a link to the discussion where I'm back and forth with Joe Rahm on this, but they are extremely specific. They do not include Kyoto or Kyoto-like policies. They include no cap-and-trade system. They include no carbon tax, et cetera. I mean, it's a question of fact, so it's probably not worth us, you know, debating it here, but I'll simply make the point that I'll link to it, that that's just it's a factually erroneous statement that those scenarios that Joe made, that scenarios include those. On the second...
Well, they don't include Kyoto, but they do include active government policies.
That's true. They include active government policies. They do not include the specific things I was calling out in my response to your initial question, which are pricing carbon or putting a cap on carbon emissions or limiting it in other analogous ways. But again, I mean, this is just a really it's a question that we determine through factual research, and I'll point the link and people can make, I guess, decide if I'm making facts up or not. On the second point, which is that, you know, a group of 26 scientists produced a report. Interestingly, of course, in a certain way, this is making it more sound he said, she said, although I think your point is they are simply reflecting more updated information. I think that the fundamental problem with this argument, which now you get a lot, which, you know, you used to get, by the way, it's the mirror image of the argument that people on the right were making, which is the IPCC process is corrupted. It's not to say your argument's corrupted, but the IPCC process is biased for some reason. And the people on the right were for a long time, and many still are, saying, look, that science is making this sound much worse than it really is. Let me show you my scientists who say it's actually not that bad. I think as I've made the argument, and others have made the argument, that, you know, if you actually read the IPCC reports, it's hard to justify these actions. Frequently now, a version of this argument made in good faith with factual basis is made, which is, hey, look, there are these other guys now who say the IPCC science is conservative. And I think there are some problems with it. The most foundational is, if it were a realistic way of reviewing all available information and coming to a conclusion about what the many thousands of science reports in hundreds of different specialties say, to get a group of scientists together and have 20 seconds go off and go back and give us a report, there'd be no reason to have the IPCC process. I mean, the reason we do it and spend all this money on it and all this time on it is it's actually hard to do that. And what I'd say is, yeah, you know, the meter we have to give a measurement of the scientific consensus takes a while to read, but it doesn't mean that we can skip the step and pretend we don't need it. And the current best read produced by that process is the one I'm citing, and when it's updated, it's updated, and until it's not, it's not. And I think further that this argument that, look, all the indicators are going the wrong way, you know, ice flow is going this way, and so on, is a really tough one to make when temperatures haven't been going up for 10 years, right? Now, you and I assume you believe that, you know, the argument that this means global warming has stopped is sort of silly. There's a lot of noise around trend, and, you know, what we're seeing is noise. But, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. I mean, that applies to indicators that tend to be running above trend, too, right? You can't, I think, argue that ice flow is going hot and therefore that means our science is conservative. But when temperature goes cool, that's just noise. I think that much noise around trend is one of many indications for why we need a big process to sort through the information and why we need the IPCC.
Fair enough. I do want to clarify that I don't think it's right that the green critique of IPCC is the mirror image of the right. In that, I don't think anybody. Well, I won't say anybody. I don't think I don't mean to impeach the IPCC credibility anyway. I think the process is conservative for good reasons, some of which you cite, which is that you want to get information that is absolutely as bulletproof as possible. And so sort of the nature of that process is eliminating a lot of stuff that's slightly more speculative. And also, it's conservative for political reasons in that you, and for reasons of human nature, you have to get a very large number of people with presumably a fairly wide range of views about specific things, all to sign off, and then you have to get a very large number of politicians to sign off. So that kind of process is going to, by virtue of the way it's set up, produce fairly conservative, small c conservative,
yep,
conclusions. So that I think there's a legitimate debate to be had, and it is starting to crop up about, even if you respect that process and acknowledge its worth and its value, whether it is sufficient now to produce the information we need to be making choices on the time scale that we think we need to be making them. Because the next report isn't going to come out, I think, until 2011 and 2012 or something like that, and that's...
Yep.
Or is it even later? I forget.
It should be. If it's 5 years, yeah, that's when it should be. You know, I accept the nuance of that difference as being both correct, a correct nuance and a non-trivial one. I think that at the level of abstraction, however, of when the argument, when the outcome of the IPCC reports seems to argue for action, those who oppose action disproportionately look inside the black box and for some reason find rationales for why really this is too aggressive and it's the opposite of small c conservative, and those who find that they want more action than seems to be implied by the IPCC process look inside the black box, they find incentives and rationales for why it's the reverse. I'm not saying either of those critiques is right or wrong. I'm simply kind of noting that it is it's a striking and kind of amusing irony. I think ultimately we do have to engage on those critiques themselves, and I guess I've given you my view about why I think the critique of it takes too long and is too slow is not really a valid critique. And in that, even if correct, it doesn't answer the question, well, if this is what is necessary to be able to synthesize this information correctly, that's just how long it takes, and we have to live with that gap, time gap in knowledge, not pretend that we have knowledge we don't. I think the other critique you've just made, which is also a really useful one, is about the incentives and bias that will tend to make it conservative. But I think that the problem there is, you know, empirically, if you look at, like, the most basic scientific scaling parameter that comes out of this, which is climate sensitivity, you know, which is, as you know, how much temperature will increase if you double atmospheric concentration of CO2. If you look,
you saw the recent report on that as well, right?
And there were lots of recent reports. You know, if you got to Joe, was talking about a recent report 2 years ago that now it looks like it's twice what we thought it was. The standard estimate from the current IPCC report, just to give people a sense of it, is doubling CO2 makes temperature go up about 3 degrees plus or minus 1.5 degrees. And what's fascinating is that if you go all the way back to Arrhenius, who's the guy who first discovered this, postulated this effect over 100 years ago. You know, he estimated not 3 degrees, about 5 degrees. And estimates that have been done in individual reports have bounced around between 0 and 10 degrees constantly for the last 100 years. But when really good groups get together and say, okay, what do we think the estimate is? The first one I'm aware of was in 1979, which is the Charney Commission, which said, we think it's about 3 degrees, plus or minus 1.5 degrees. And then there have been 4 IPCC reports over 20 years, and every one keeps coming back at, yeah, it's about 3 degrees, plus or minus 1.5 degrees. It's still where we are. So I think it's really misleading. It's a easy conceptual trap to fall into, to say I've got a data point which reads high or reads low, and I'm going to believe that I've seen now deviation, and this is now the best available information. Well, the fact is there's immense noise in reading the science just as there is in the underlying data. It's why I believe you actually need a real synthesis process, and why it's not just kind of political, theater to go through the IPCC process.
Well, what do you make of the new physical evidence that seems to show adverse effects happening more substantially and sooner than predicted by the IPCC or projected by the IPCC?
I'm not competent to judge it. Right, I'm not competent to integrate that and draw conclusions that we need to update scientific consensus. And I don't think anybody is, actually. I don't think any Isaac Newton is not, as an individual, competent to do that. I think we need a real process to integrate it. And I've made a point that I think the most fundamental indicator of global warming, which is warming, actually is not above trend. It's way below trend right now. So I think it's hard to argue that we've got, all the indicators are pointing one way. I think at least the most basic ones pointing the other way.
All right. Well, we won't settle the science here. let's turn instead to economics, because I mean, if you want to know, to sort of cut to the chase of how I view this, I feel like, to me, a large reason that this discussion is somewhat the larger discussion about these issues is somewhat dysfunctional is that it takes place in the frame of addressing climate change, reducing emissions, is going to be painful and deleterious and slow economic growth, et cetera, et cetera. So once you accept that premise, then you're stuck with this international process that is very much all parties trying to give up as little as possible while getting as much as possible.
Right.
And everybody sort of defensively backing into whatever commitments they may make. And, the political process in the U.S., this sort of hovering notion that this is a big bucket of pain and Congress's job is to dole out the pain in appropriate bundles to appropriate demographics, which is, I think, very much how they view it. And these are based on macroeconomic forecasts of economic growth, of technology innovation, of any number of factors which can affect an economy, which as you said earlier, are to put it charitably, less than rigorously scientific. And I might add, if you go back and look at the results of previous forecasts about not just economic growth but energy demand, energy supply, all these factors that feed into ultimately the decision about how hard this is going to be, have been wrong 100% of the time, more or less, in the past. So it's peculiar to me that, on one sense, where the public is sitting around arguing about science, which we know is incredible confidence right now.
Right,
and on the other hand, there's this accepted conventional wisdom that we know exactly what the economic in fact, it's going to be, when it seems to me we don't know that any better than if we had goat bones thrown out in front of us or something.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, a less polite and charming guy than you would have put the questions. Gee, Jim, you just told me you think macroeconomics is he said, she said, and your whole argument depends on macroeconomic forecasts, right? So I think that, first of all that any of the economic modeling on this question can do is to ensure that we use a consistent set of assumptions when we think about a problem. Thinking that we are going to be able to reliably forecast the world economy in the year, never mind our technology, in the year 2230 is, ludicrous. Let me ask you about this in a different way, which is what you're saying that you think that the things we would do to reduce carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas emissions will be profitable independent of that, i.e. they will increase total consumption independent of that, or do you think there is actually a cost to be paid in foregone consumption to implement these programs?
Well, I mean, there's things to pick apart. A lot of what goes under the banner of cost, to me, is better characterized as investment. So, if I weather seal my windows, whatever, mm-hmm. it's a cost. Right? It's a cost of whatever, $3,000. But over time, my energy savings pay that back, and eventually I'm getting a reasonably, not huge, but a decent and reliable rate of return on that investment, and I come out in the black. So the investments required to shift away from fossil fuels to a system based primarily on renewable energy and just as importantly, radically increased energy efficiency are going to be huge. They're going to be substantial. But our investments in infrastructure and energy over the next 40 years are going to be huge regardless of what happens, just for sheer demographic reasons, the rise of demand, the growth of GDP means, for any number of reasons that I know you're familiar with. So the question here, I guess, is two questions. One is, if looking forward to 2050, if we do this, if we really go whole hog, try to ramp up our efficiency in every way we know how, try in every way we know how to scale up renewable energies and et cetera, really go whole hog, will we in 2050 look back and say, we're glad we did that? Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. That's one question. And I think, to me, the answer to that question is yes, absolutely yes.
Can I modify your question?
Well, let me do the second one. And you can, the second question is, will we look back and say we're glad we did it in 2 years, or 5 years, mm-hmm. or in time spans that are more relevant to the political considerations mm-hmm. that are governing mm-hmm. these decisions, mm-hmm. right? And in that, I am confident that we could do it in such a way that the vast majority of people would benefit at most stages from it. But I couldn't begin to predict. Yeah. I mean, anybody who claims to know that is more or less guessing. I mean, it depends on a number of factors, what we decide to do, what policies are, et cetera, et cetera.
So what I was going to ask is, it's a very helpful way to think about it, in my view. What I was going to ask is, if you're trying to answer your first question, which is in 2050 we will look back and say, boy, that was a good choice. If you mm-hmm. hold out for the moment any benefits we get in the form of avoiding global warming damages, and just for the moment ignore that, and we don't get to count that in our calculation, is it your view that in 2050 we'd look back and say, boy, we're really glad we did that?
Yes. Okay. Absolutely.
And is it your view that we would do that but with an economic hat on, meaning you might have a view that, gee, people ought to live differently than they do, and, all this consumption is not a good thing. But if you were to put an economic hat on, say, do you think we will be as rich in 2050 under that scenario, excluding global warming effects, as we would be if we did not do the things you're advocating? Do you think the answer to that question would be yes?
Right. In a sense, that's more difficult to answer because there's so many assumptions mm-hmm. bound up in how we think about these things.
Yeah.
So if the question is, will GDP be as high as it was projected to be now?
Well,
in the terms we measure it now, I don't know. I can't say confidently that we'll be richer versus poorer on that metric.
Gotcha.
But I, for reasons I know you're probably familiar with, have a lot of questions about the validity of that metric. I think it's entirely possible that we could have a lower GDP than we thought we would, mm-hmm. and still overwhelmingly be glad that we did what we did.
Gotcha. So, how many of the decisions do you think, to make this real kind of practical, and your illustration of weatherizing your windows is great, right? Or weatherizing your house is great. So there's an argument that says, I had to weatherize my house because, I spend, in a stylized example, I spend $10 a day to weatherize my house, but my heating bills are $1 lower every year, and so I get to eat more cheesesteaks and pizza, every year than I would have otherwise, right? And so if I take the cheesesteaks and pizza I sacrifice eating now, in fact, I have enough more cheesesteaks and pizza in the future that net-net, even if the consumer's hat on, that was a smart idea. There are decisions that that would be of that nature. Then I guess there might be decisions that would be of that nature, but I can't do them as one company or one person. I need to have a law change because there's some kind of collective action problem. But we actually get better consumption. And then there are decisions in which I don't get more cheesesteaks and pizza. I'm actually giving up some cheesesteaks and pizza, but I'm getting these other benefits for them. And I guess and this is an ideological point of view, although I think I hold it firmly and I think it's defensible, that if we're talking about decisions which are like weatherizing my house, in which I am better off doing it, even in a narrowest consumer sense, that if that's true, and those are the things that are going to basically decarbonize the economy, then why do we need any laws? I mean, people will just do it, right? So I think that unless you think their consciousness needs to be raised in some way, you have to be arguing for either there are collective action problems such that this greater consumption can only happen at a national or supranational level, or you have to be arguing that these are decisions we wouldn't take otherwise. In fact, we are bearing some perceived expected value of economic cost at the moment of the decision. Was that clear what I was asking? It was kind of very convoluted.
Absolutely clear, and I like that way of framing it. I do think it clarifies things. My answer would be, well, let's focus in on efficiency specifically, since that's what we're sort of dancing around here. Efficiency in terms of investments you make that will allow you to use less energy, which would pay off over time. And this is a very familiar question to anybody who's an advocate of efficiency, which is, if there are all these investments which could be made and would be cost positive or cost negative, which would pay people off, why aren't they making those investments? And so my first response would be, well, there's two categories of response. The first one has to do with markets, which is that would be true in perfect markets. In perfect markets, and by perfect I mean, you know, the sort of idealized market of low barriers to entry, you know, low barriers to exit, no monopolies, transparent information, the sort of idealized market of economists' fantasies. I do think in that situation, a great deal more of these investments would be being made. But if you really go and look at the market or the markets, multiple markets involved in energy efficiency, they're ridden with market failures, as economists call them. Some of them are fairly, lots of them are well understood. Overcoming them is not as well understood. But you know, misaligned incentives and all sorts of blockages in our information flows. And I mean, just take as an example, the U.S. utility industry. Half of it is regulated, half of it isn't. You know, I mean, these are the primary instruments of dispersing electricity, which is going to be much more important relative to liquid fuels, I think, going forward. Electricity is the big game. These are the primary instruments for creating and distributing electricity in the U.S., and they are the farthest thing possible from market actors. I mean, for a regulated utility, your skill is not competing with other people who are trying to do it. Your skill is how to massage the regulators who govern your, you know what I mean? So I mean, that's a very big, glaring example, but all the way down the line, there are market failures. So
let's dive
correcting those, making those markets more perfect, I think, is a perfectly legitimate goal for public policy.
Right, exactly. So, I think utilities are sort of poster child A1 for, political markets, right? But I think that if one accepts the premise that in an imperfect way, better than any available alternative kind of way, that markets should allow people to make decisions like weatherizing their house, then if these are the kinds of decisions that would decarbonize, I think one would naturally argue not to go in and monkey around with the regulations as a strategy in the utility industry, but to deregulate it, right? That if you accept
I would sign on that dotted line, although I think I might be somewhat of an outcast among I really don't know what the aggregate opinion among environmentalists of that is, but I would be for deregulation.
So I mean, if we say I was going to presume something, I should ask a question. Let's say not we got to the magic economist perfect world, but we got to the kind of deregulation that we've had in airlines and other industries. And we undid some of these blockages, a lot of them, to markets, so that people really could, you know, if they chose to, they would be able to do things like that are the moral equivalent of weatherizing their house. Is it your view that at that point, markets would drive us to the right answer in terms of decarbonizing, or that there needs to be coercive intervention to change what those, to put our thumb on the scale one way or another in that decision, in those set of decisions, to get to the answer we need?
My instinct is to say that if the markets hold the ecological truth, that is, if to the extent
right.
possible, given our limited information or whatever, we incorporated externalities into market prices and rationalized markets and removed informational barriers and et cetera, all these things you would want to do, which is obviously in itself kind of an idealized, I mean, obviously you're never going to get to a perfect market, but
right.
to the extent we move in that direction, yes, I think the economy would decarbonize itself. I do think, I do think if the true costs of fossil fuels were reflected in their market prices, we would already be well along the road, and being well along the road, it wouldn't look as expensive to us as it looks now, because we would, you know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, we would have gone up a much more gentle slope, but we would have started a long time ago, but for various reasons, fossil fuels have, economic and political reasons, have sort of, you know, grabbed their place in the market and hold it in ways that are as much political as they are economic. So in a sense, at this point, a little bit of blunt force is required. But I do think, yes, to be more concise, yes, in a perfect market, decarbonization would happen naturally.
You know, I think that we've really reached, in my view, a good point here, because I think that there is there's a huge open question, right, which is, pardon me, I'm at the end of a whole bunch of long meetings, so I'm starting to cough. I think there is a huge point here, which is, the way I'd put it is, gee, Jim, yeah, markets work great as long as we don't ignore the fact that we are consuming a non-renewable resource called air we can breathe every time we pump out some CO2, and therefore we have a fake market which doesn't reflect that cost. And
right.
I think that there's a question which I don't think can be answered, which is, Hayek talked about this, you know, the great libertarian philosopher and economist F.A. Hayek said, it is an assumption, I'm paraphrasing here, it is an assumption of libertarian economics that resources are infinite. And what he was saying was, this specific resource, like the oil from this particular well, is obviously not infinite, but it is an assumption that we will continue to ingeniously invent new ways to create the value that those resources are creating that we are consuming. And
well, you know, it's funny, that's the mirror image of a frequent environmental point, which is to say that robust economic growth is perfectly possible without growth of finite resource consumption, that growth can be decoupled from resource consumption, which is, in a sense, another way of saying the same thing.
They're very related. Yes, I agree. And so I agree with that. And I think that a lot of this, when you really take an open mind to it and you try and address the facts, you do come down to this question of unprovable visions or worldviews. I think that there's a good faith area of disagreement and not resolvable in the ways I can think of, you know, anyway, by fact, which is, do we believe that we will be able to create new economic value of resources as we consume resources, or is there just, you know, the glass is full of a certain amount of stuff, and when it's gone, it's gone? I don't know if a good answer to that question. I do think that it creates a natural limiting boundary on libertarian economics. I say this as a libertarian, that as a you know, a small L libertarian, that it is important for us to try and think about, are we going to hit some stopping condition? However, I think the flip side of that is, it is extremely difficult for us to predict when that's going to happen. As much as we think we can predict we're going to, you know, when peak oil is going to be, when we're going to put too much CO2 in the atmosphere and its impact, and so on. But the flip side of it is, we need to be extremely humble about our ability to forecast when and if that's going to happen. And I think this is not a question that sort of gets answered and you're done and then you have an answer. It requires sensitivity about both constantly probing for that weakness, that problem, but being extremely skeptical about our belief to know when we're getting close to it.
Well, I mean, I do think a good point libertarians have is that if you're looking to determine things like that, you're much better off letting several million aggregate intellects loose on it than you are sitting in a room and trying to figure it out. So in a sense, I think markets are good at figuring stuff like that out in the aggregate. In the aggregate, with the very, very important proviso that they are that way in perfect conditions. And to the extent they fall short of perfect conditions, they also fall short of that sort of collective intelligence function that they serve. So I also want us to be sensitive of the ways that markets are distorted and blocked, and the ways that those distortions and blockages might be obscuring information about resources running out. I wanted to get to the other half of my answer before, though, because I do think it feeds back in here. So there's market failures on the one hand, but then there are also what let me wave around and get my light turned on again. there's also what economists who study efficiency call behavioral failures, which is a econo speak, I think, for human nature.
Right.
The failure of human beings to behave like economists think
right,
they ought
right,
to.
Right. Right.
You know, and so this is something I've been very, very keenly interested in lately and want to pursue more, but understanding our natural human cognitive weaknesses in irrationalities and our instincts and all these sort of ways that the human animal behaves and reacts, and the sort of behavioral tics we have and behavioral routines we have, some of those also serve to obscure. For instance, if we were much better at making long-term decisions, which we're notoriously not, I again think if we were better at that, we would have started decarbonizing a long time ago. Again, I think to the extent that human beings had something more like perfect rationality, they would have started decarbonizing a long time ago. So the question is, and this gets very sticky for a libertarian, and when it comes to social issues, I think I would even describe myself as a libertarian, so it's a little sticky for me too, but the question is, to the extent you can come to understand those human behavioral features, and I think, you know, it's not a hard science, but I think there's a lot of very good experimental data and a lot of good information available, can you tweak policies and tweak markets to try to get those features of human behavior working for you instead of against you? Because right now a lot of them work against conservation, a lot of them work against sensible investments, a lot of them, you know, for obvious reasons. So the intriguing part of this is that some of these interventions you could do can have a pretty substantial effect with no cost. They're cost-free. So, for instance, if you put on people's utility bills, include the information, here is the average amount of energy that your neighbors use, and you use X amount less or X amount more. If you give people that information, you get like an almost instant 5% decrease in energy use. And that's no additional cost, no additional coercive intervention. It's just knowing how humans think and making use of it to get what you want. And I think in the aggregate, if we had a lot more of that knowledge and used it a lot more systematically, I think we could get some pretty big progress just out of that. But it's peculiar. Like these discussions are focused so intensely on technology and economics, and so little on human beings and how they behave and how they think. It seems to me that's a huge gap, and it also seems to me like an area where conservatives and liberals could come to some consensus positions, because it's like Cass Sunstein's book, Nudge, you know, paternal, whatever the hell the phrase is.
Yeah.
Libertarian with a nice, you know, non-coercive, yeah. So I think there's great potential for that. You sound leery.
Well, there's a famous saying, right? I have my reasons and you have your biases. And the irony, of course, of I'm sure it's not lost on you, of a purportedly irrational set of human beings determining what human irrationalities are and correcting them. And I think that it is difficult at a practical level for me to imagine that there are a bunch of behavioral tics that can be manipulated at the level of printing on someone's power bill what their neighbors are using that are going to drive the kind of change that, that you're arguing to drive. I'm not disputing that particular point. In fact, the one experiment I know about that was done in a dorm, if I'm remembering it correctly. And I do think that one of the famous problems of experimental economics, or from my find to be pervasive in experimental economics and experimental psychology, is, you know, here's what 30 college sophomores did for beer money, therefore all of humanity is risk averse or something. You know, so it, right. the net effect of those interventions over time as they percolate through society are often less predictable than they seem like from a simple experiment. That said, I'm sure there are specific things, either exactly what you described or like it, that can be used to, on the margin, you know, create some positive improvement.
And certainly you could, and certainly social science, social psychology, social sciences get about 2% of the research money in this area. So it seems at the very least we could find out more of them. I mean, one thing to remember, and this is something I think I run into a lot of intuitive skepticism about this, and I'm just sort of getting into it really, but one of the things I like to tell people is there is a group of people who has figured these things out and has used them, in fact, to drive massive changes, massive economy shifting changes in behavior, and that is the advertising industry. I mean, if you want to see scale of changes, everybody in the world has an iPod. Everybody, you know,
Yeah. Everybody
drives big cars now, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's not like you can't, it's not like the aggregate of these changes in behavior can't scale up to something fairly large.
Well, I think that, you know, the reason I'm not doing blog posting is I'm all the time I'm devoting writing, I'm pretty much devoting to a book, and it's basically on this question of, can social science be more scientific through experimentation, and what have we found through experiments thus far? And as someone who's also been very involved in evaluating the causal impact of advertisements on purchases, I'll tell you that almost all programs that attempt to manage, you know, human behavior through incentive change, non-coercive incentive changes, you know, almost none work. And when they work, they change behavior, you know, tiny percentages. That doesn't mean they don't pay out versus their costs, which is why there's an advertising industry. But I don't think you can lay large cars, by example, at the feet of advertising for large cars as opposed to underlying desires as percolated through the details of our society. So I guess what I'm saying is inevitably social reformers on both the left and right and in the middle who envision a new world and are frustrated by people not going along, you know, envision changing human nature or human behavior. And it almost always, in fact, I would argue always, turns out to be much, much harder than we envision it to be. We envision the new man, the new person. But, you know, the old saying, right, I have no straight thing, whatever.
I 100% agree with that point. I 100% agree, and this is something I argue with environmentalists about, is this strain of environmentalism that's waiting patiently for this revolution in consciousness
right.
after which everything else is
going
to... Right. And it's fine with me if they wait for that change in consciousness and they demand the most grandiose possible solutions. My problem is when they then turn on solutions that they see as insufficient.
Right.
As insufficiently revolutionary and try to bring them down, but that's a separate argument.
I totally agree with you.
The point I want to make is I'm explicitly not talking about changing human behavior or human nature. I'm talking about clever ways of arranging circumstances and institutions to make use of human nature and human behavior in more positive ways that contribute to social welfare. So just learning about it so you know how to phrase a request or how to arrange the information on an electricity bill or anything like that. I mean, there's good information about how to do that stuff to get socially positive results. It's not very well dispersed. Nobody really knows it. Nobody really seems to think about it.
Look, I'm with you. The software company I started and ran for a long time basically is used to run experiments that have been done things like, if we change the order of things on a menu, do we sell more or fewer hamburgers, right? So I'm deeply into this question. And I agree that there's untapped opportunity. I think that one of the practical lessons of doing that for a long time is, you know, you create tiny changes on the margin that can add up pebble by pebble to a big mountain, but it's very hard to do. And I think if you think about the scale of what's being talked about, like you know, the numbers that are being thrown around Copenhagen are the U.S. should have, what is it, like 80% less emissions than it otherwise would have by 2050. Mm-hmm. You know, unless you have technology change, you know, fossil fuels are what, like 80% of our energy mix? So you're talking about, unless you can reduce intensity of emissions per unit energy consumption, that's like two-thirds of all energy consumed in the United States, right? If you follow what I'm saying, right? I mean, 0.8 times 0.8 is 0.64, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, well, we're talking about over a few decades, either inventing technology to decarbonize fossil energy or radically, it seems to me, changing the basic energy infrastructure of the country. And, you know, I'm not saying that's impossible to do, but I think to achieve anything like that is, you have to, I can't imagine, maybe it's my failure of imagination, accomplishing that in 41 years in the absence of pretty heavy coercion.
Yeah. Well, I guess I mean my response would be, I think I probably agree with you that there's an overemphasis domestically and internationally on targets, on these sort of grandiose statements of purpose, which, when unconnected to any sort of concrete policies, are almost entirely sort of affective,
right,
and positional,
right,
and, you know, theatrical.
I agree.
I'm not saying there's no value to that stuff, but I would like to see a much heavier emphasis on small bore but real policies,
right,
starting to be implemented on the ground.
Right.
And ultimately, I think, can we do this by 2050? Nobody has any idea at all. So I think the thing to do, less than sort of say, here's our scientific plotting out of steps that will achieve this, because nobody knows. Like, just as you say, it's hard to predict the outcome of attempts to tweak, you know, people's behavior. The same is true for economic policy, technology policy. And ultimately, it's very hard to predict the future. Right?
I mean, exactly.
So it seems to me that the thing to do, the turn we need to make, is to really decide, as a country, we see where we want to go. And everybody, from federal policymakers right on down to business owners, right on down to homeowners, needs to just start thinking, well, how can, you know, what can I do to get a little bit closer there? And I feel like once more people are invested in this effort and start seeing real things happening, start seeing real things changing around them, there's going to be a bandwagon effect. There's going to be innovation that we can't possibly predict now. And I think in principle shifts that big are possible, but the thing to do is not try to prove one way or the other whether it's possible, which is a lot of people waste a lot of time on these things.
Right.
But instead, it's just decide. It's like how we make decisions whether to go to war or not. You never see this sort of nickel and diming economic projection. People try to decide, is this in the national interest to do it? And then, secondly, they decide, well, can we do it? And then, third, if at all, which is rarely, they decide, well, can we pay for it? Is it deficit neutral, right? I mean,
right,
that question never comes,
right,
up. So, to me, it seems much more like that kind of thing. Like, let's just decide and find out whether we can do it.
Right. Well, I really agree strongly with one thing you said, and I don't agree precisely with the other part. So the thing I agree with is, you know, I do think this emphasis on stating these long-term targets is it's mostly theatrics, as you say. In fact, one of the things I've been impressed by the Obama administration and the U.S. government in general, actually, and the British government to the extent I've seen it up close, is they're surprisingly uncynical about this, right? It seems to me if you were a true cynic, what you would do is simply declare a long-term target, right? You say, yeah, okay, great, we have a target. You know, we're gonna take 80% out by 2050, and, you know, you're out of office and probably dead by then. You can't possibly be held accountable to it. You don't really have to do anything, and you get all these plaudits. So as someone who has pointed out many of the inevitable problems in a democracy that lead to carbon taxes and cap and trade not really working out the way they, in theory, are supposed to, I think our political culture is impressive in that it is actually trying to speak honestly about this in a way that I think most national political cultures don't. I mean, I think most of what we're seeing on the world stage is pure cynicism. And so, you know, I agree that, you know, focusing on, well, let's do things that are practical and actually accomplish something is really the right way to focus. The part that I
and then I think the conversation in 5 years one way or the other, is going to look a lot different.
Well, that's true, but I think that, you know, the second part of what you said, which is related to what you just said, is you said, I think we just, something like, we just need to decide. And I think the problem is, just deciding, like in your analogy, the way we go to war, means one of two things. I think just deciding means the government decides and coerces people through taxes or other forms, or you have the consciousness-raising exercise. I mean, I think you continue to butt into this problem of people aren't making this decision naturally, and you have to either change the way they make decisions or force them to change. And I think
what about persuasion?
Fair enough. That's consciousness raising. That's what I mean by consciousness raising. But one would need to persuade people to value things differently. In other words, it's not just you're not aware of this fact that if you know it, with your current decision calculus will lead you to behave differently. I think it is you have to prefer this kind of way of living, and I'm speaking super abstractly here, to that kind of way of living, to get the kind of scale of change we're talking about. And I think that in the end, that's the rock one keeps coming up crashing.
Well, I think that's valid, and this is the reason that I've come back to this focus on getting things actually started,
yep.
Which is that I don't think, and this also gets back to my point about understanding human nature and human cognition and behavior. I don't think people really have a decision calculus, to be honest. I mean, I think the vast majority of decisions we make, are made based on factors that we are never aware of.
I couldn't agree more with that. Decision calculus, I was using in a rough sense, but I totally agree with you, by the way. We mostly post-justify
the rationality
of our decisions.
Right. I don't think people really make rational decisions. People make, and one of the things they're learning in social psychology is that lots of decisions are based on social cues.
Yep.
And one family of social cues is people like me are doing things like this, right? And that's immensely powerful. So the more you make things real, the more actual people on the ground are doing things visible to other people on the ground, that's what's going to create the shift in behavior and the shift in consciousness. This is another thing I argue with my fellow environmentalists about. The shift in consciousness will come, shifts in consciousness always come after shifts in behavior, not before. It's your behavior that shapes your consciousness, not the other way around. So just get people to start doing different things, and the change in consciousness will come after that. But the focus, the overwhelming focus should be on get things happening.
Well, that does the virtue of practicality. I mean, I think maybe a place to end is a point of, you know, agreement here, which is to sort of be of a practical example. I think if you could, one could run a bunch of randomized control trials and demonstrate that by putting something different on people's bill about what their neighbors are consuming, we can drive energy consumption, electricity consumption in the United States down 5%. You'd be looking at the biggest booster in the world doing that. It just for 10,000 reasons would be real smart. I'm only expressing skepticism about can you really get to where you want to go through those kinds of mechanisms? But what I'd say is, you know, go to it, right? I mean, if we can go out and start doing stuff like that,
right.
Boy, would that be great. That would be the best possible answer to all this.
Yeah, I think the core of what I'm trying to say is that action begets action.
Yeah.
Action feeds on itself. So can we get there with that? No, but can we get farther than that based on that? Yes, and then I think what you get is sort of you get over time, cumulatively, much bigger changes than you ever would have thought.
Yeah.
Predictably.
Yep.
Starting early on, that's my hope. That's what happened in, you know, it's what happened in cell phones being distributed. I mean, it's happened before that much bigger changes than we expected came from factors that we couldn't have predicted. But we're agreeing on something, so that's a good. Also, we're over time.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure we could talk forever. But
I'm sure all three people still listening would be really fascinated.
Exactly. You all get a cookie. The three remaining blog watchers. All right. Well, it's been a pleasure.
You too. This has been great. I look forward to talking again
soon. Okay. Bye now.
Thanks. Bye.